When Auckland writer, editor, blogger and all-round poetry champion Paula Green was at school, she remembers her teacher standing over her and telling her she'd never be a writer. Not if she carried on the way she was going. So Paula Green wrote silently. In secret, she kept writing, but didn't show anyone. She didn't tell anyone. Well, in 2017, Paula Green was awarded the Poetry Prize and the Prime Minister's Awards for Literary Achievement and the New Year's Honours. That same year, she was appointed a member of the New Zealand Order of Merit. And across the last 20 years, she has released more than a dozen books, including three this year. And Paula Green is my guest today on Bookmarks. We'll talk poetry, writing. She has some fantastic music for us, and we'll also get to talk movies and TV too. Paula, kia ora. Welcome to Afternoons.
Kia ora. Lovely to be here.
Yeah, good to have you on. That notion of a teacher standing over you and telling you you'd never be a writer is quite an image.
It is quite an image, and it's actually been quite a useful one, but what she said to me, it was my Year 12 English class, and I'd always been writing. My father was a minister, and I used to go into his study before I started school, and I would write in the books. So they had to elevate the books and create a shelf for me where I could write. And I have no idea what I was writing. I would sit at the typewriter writing. So it was just this thing in me that words were good. And I think, you know, listening to sermons, there's some kind of music about them, some kind of song, not necessarily the meaning, but just the lyricism. And also reading the Bible, the lyricism and the song of that, you know. So, and I loved going into the garden and reciting A.A. Milne. So I always had these words in me, yeah. And then when I was in teacher at intermediate school, this felt like the highlight of my schooling days. I had two amazing teachers and I just adored them. I was hungry for learning. I was hungry for books. And one of my teachers was a poet called Frederick Palmy, and he ended up being in this book called Big Smoke, which is an anthology of 60s and 70s poets in New Zealand. And he was just the most eccentric character. But anyway, from there, it was kind of like a downhill slide at secondary school. And I failed Year 12, so I failed school. But I actually feel like the school failed me. And I think, you know, I was always kind of like an awkward fit at school, but I had that hunger for learning. And the fact that I was an awkward fit, I've taken with me. So I'm really suspicious of kind of dogma and boxes and, you know, you ought to do this, you ought to be that, you ought to write like this, you know. And so I think all my roads from there, I went to university and studied Italian, and that gave me license to be someone different, to inhabit a different language, you know. And I loved it so much I stayed till there were no more degrees left, you know. And there I am on the stage getting that little funny box on my head, and I'm thinking, take that Year 12 English teacher.
Take that Year 12.
Yeah, because she said, you're right, in front of the English class, she said, your writing will get you nowhere in the world if you continue to write like you do.
I can't believe it.
And so, you know, I feel like that affected me as a mother. It affects me as a person who writes for children, because I want that. I want openness, you know. I want liberation and openness.
Interesting to hear your father being a minister of religion, I can understand. Yeah. Because my father was a minister of religion too, Methodist minister.
Really?
So I can recall Saturday afternoons, him being at his desk and him reciting or going over his sermon and outside the office. Yeah. And I can really relate to, there's nothing like a jolly good sermon, not too long, but takes you in. There's a lyricism about it, eh?
Exactly, a lyricism, yeah, a lyricism.
So and that kind of influenced you?
Yeah, it did. Not in a religious sense, but in the sense of telling stories and doing things with words, yeah. And so, yeah.
And poetry is on your mind today, as it is most days, I take it. You've released not one, not two, but three books of your own this year. So you have some poetry books to recommend written by other people today. So before we get to those, do you just want to talk through your 2019 releases?
I released The Track, which was my own poetry, which came out of me, and I talked about this with Lynn Freeman. I fractured my foot on the Queen Charlotte Track on the most spectacular day, and as pain relief, I composed a book-length poem in my head, and that's now out there as The Track. And then I published...
The Track, is it called The Track?
The Track, yeah.
I love it.
Keeping on the track. And then I published a collection of children's poetry called Groovy Fish, and I did the drawings for it, which was the coolest thing. I used to loved drawing as a child, so to get back to drawing was really, really wonderful. And all the titles are from children all around New Zealand, so that really took me outside my comfort zone. You know, I was writing, which has taken 4 years to write.
Is this
Wild,
it here?
Yeah, Wild Honey, Reading New Zealand Women's Poetry, published by Massey University Press. It feels like all the roads in my life have led to this book, and it's the book that had never been written. It's the book about... I wanted to bring the women of the 20th century who wrote poetry into the light. For much of the 20th century, they were in the shadows. They were, you know, undermined, misread, devalued by men and kept out of the canon. And I wanted to bring them back so that I could celebrate them. And I decided to build a house for them. So the book's structured like a house with lots of different rooms. And I take different women into rooms in the house and we go before objects and then I open up the door, go through the door into the wider world and end up at the sky. And Sally Blundell and The Listener described it as an open home, and I really loved that because I wanted all the windows and doors to be open. I wanted the movement through the house, and I wanted diversity, and I wanted it to be kind of full of warmth and love and connection. And to begin with, I had toxic stories, and I'm not going to share them with you, toxic stories about what men have done in terms of women poets across the century, and to me, the ways in which I've been personally muted by males, you know, writers in New Zealand. I just thought, actually, no, I don't want that in here. So
right.
I banished them.
Yes.
They weren't allowed in the house because I thought I don't want that toxicity taking up room here. I want it to be a different kind of book that, yeah, is more like a celebration and shows, and I'm going back to that awkward misfit of a child who failed school to say, you know, we can write in a different kind of way. And the book has been out in the world maybe 3-4 weeks, and I've just had so many women come up to me. They like to tell me where they're reading the book, which I find fascinating. They like to tell me how it's making them feel, and it's full of warmth. And they also might say, you know, I don't read non-fiction, but this book is welcoming me in. And that just seems like, wow, it's just such a...
What an affirmation.
Yeah, that's the word. It's an affirmation. And I've had, I don't know how many events now around New Zealand where we come together. I try and get 10 local poets reading, mostly women, but with some men, and celebrating their writing and women's writing. And every time, there's never been a launch like it. So in Wellington, we had our elders. We had Dame Fiona Kidman, extraordinary woman writing in the 1970s. Her first love was poetry. Rachel McAlpine, all these kind of groundbreaking women. But then we had Tay Tibble, Sugar Magnolia Wilson, women who are just coming onto the scene now. So there was this
a rich breadth, huh?
Yeah,
yes,
and
yes.
Just such, you know, what was so astonishing was the way everyone listened to each other and, like, not even knowing of the existence of each other. So it was a really extraordinary thing, this bringing together of voices across generations and across cultures. Just
extraordinary.
Yeah, utterly.
And it says something. It really means a lot. It means a lot to say of all the things you've done that everything, in a way, has led to this book here, Wild Honey, Reading New Zealand Women's Poetry.
Mm, yeah.
Did it take a lot of work?
Yeah, it did. It took a lot of work. It took decades of reading and thinking, but 4 years of really intense writing. And I had quite a few accidents during it, but, you know, that's all gone now.
Yeah. All right, so now your first book you'd like to talk about features a poem in your Wild Honey collection. Tell us about this. Tell us about Luminescent.
Yeah, this was by Nina Mingya Pals, who is a young woman currently living in London. She grew up in both China and Wellington, and she is also the poetry editor of the Shanghai Literary Review. She has just started this exquisite little new press called Bitter Melon, and she's part of this exciting new wave of young poets. And I really love that book, Luminescent. It's like a little set of chapbooks bound together in a case, and each book is devoted to a woman. It might be Catherine Mansfield. It might be the ghost of a woman who died at a school in Wellington, an actress whose costume caught a light in a theatrical performance. So really quite different characters. And what I love about her writing is that I put her in the sky, the final section of my book, because for me the sky is, if you think about poetry, what can it do? It's the place of infinite possibilities. It's the place of beauty. And it's the place of storm. It's the place of movement. And this is what Nina's poetry does. It's just, it's full of kind of puzzles, and she imagines and she dreams, and I guess I kind of love the sky because, you know, I love those motifs like the moon and the stars and the sun. And we will never stop putting those into poetry. When will we ever get sick of a poem about the moon? Never, you know.
That's a good point, though. Yeah. The moon's evergreen, isn't it?
It is. I love that, yeah. And so this particular poem is in the book about Beatrice Tinsley, who lived from 1941 to 1981. She was a New Zealand cosmologist who worked for NASA, which I just find her story, you know, fabulous. But so this is just one of the poems in that little thing, and it's called Minutes, 1969.
Okay.
I just need to put my reading glasses on, otherwise it's a blur. The light emitted by distant galaxies takes billions of light years to reach us. It comes from a far younger universe, somewhere since expanded and receded, somewhere where no one ever worried about ironing their husband's shirts or arranging after-school childcare because there were no ironing boards and no children and no husbands and no one to think of them, only this time-travelling light, this ghost light that reaches her at dawn as she sits at the kitchen table, testing equations for galactic models in the expanding and receding minutes just before her children wake. And I really love that. I'm just going to cough. I love that because I've got a study, but I wrote this whole book at my kitchen table. And I live out with Michael Hite, my partner, and we live out in the country near Tehinga, Bethels Beach, with a few of the Waitakere ranges in the sky. And I just wanted to sit at the kitchen table with the domestic world kind of evolving around me, and the, you know, the bangs and the clatter and the clutter and the life and the food being prepared and everything. So I just love that poem because, you know, I guess as a mother, I've had a history of writing in those expanding and receding minutes before, you know, whatever I have to do as a mother calls to me, you know, which it didn't. Yeah.
Absolutely beautiful. Yeah. Well, I was just actually thinking, I'm speaking with Paula Green this afternoon, a writer, poet, Paula Green. Back to that communion, I suppose, or that that sense of community when you had the event for this. And I was wondering, that would resonate with a lot of people because oftentimes, sometimes literary events can seem a little bit competitive, a bit clicky. What you've described right there, I think a lot of people would, they'd love to be part of it. Is there any sense of actually taking that on a bit of a tour?
Well, I already have. I mean, I've been to a number of places and I'm going to more places next year. So I've just been to Palmerston North. I've done an event there last night. And I did an event in Dunedin, which was wonderful. I've done several in Wellington, three in Auckland, you know, and I'll be going to different places next year. But there is, to me, it's a sense of community, but it's also a sense of communities, plural, and the different kind of kōrero that comes, you know, the young women speaking out from their heart and saying things that matter. You know, there's such a renaissance of poetry at the moment.
Why is that, do you think? It's quite something, isn't it?
It is quite something, yeah. I think for all kinds of reasons, but it for me, poetry is the playground. It's the place you can give voice to whatever you feel and think. And it's for me, it's if you start with a child, it's utterly liberating. You know, there are no rules. As far as I'm concerned, there are no rules in poetry. So it's a liberating tool for the child.
That's it.
Yeah. And then the whole thing about performance, you know. The next book I chose is actually by Bill Manhire, and this book of his, I could have chosen any number of his, but the next book was Lifted, which I absolutely adore. And it comes back to this fundamental thing that music can be, poetry can begin with sound, it can begin with music. And he's so good at it. You know, I've picked Bill here as my second book because I feel that he has been so generous to writers and to New Zealand poetry, not just in this huge collection of writing, but in what he's done with creating the Institute in Wellington, being a teacher, and being someone who's very open and very generous to. He's been so generous to me as a writer over the last few decades, and I know so many people who have that kind of story. But I have this room in my head. I don't know if you have these little rooms, but I have rooms for my favourite things. So I've got a room for my favourite poems, where those, you know, on favourite music or favourite movie, and those are just the ones that transcend everything. And Bill once said to me that he quoted a Emily Dickinson thing to me, and he said, this is what she said, "If I feel physically as if the top of my head were taken off, I know that's poetry." You know, and I kind of love that idea, but I also felt squeamish. And I thought, it always seemed to me like a bloody thing, you know, and I'm not sure that I want blood and head guts going everywhere as an image. And so I'm thinking, how do I react to poetry? It's quite simple. I get goosebumps. So when I hear Bill reading some of the poems in Lifted, such as Hotel Emergencies, Erebus Voices, Kevin, the Ladder, these poems are so extraordinary, I get goosebumps. Or my heart starts beating faster, or my body starts swaying. So it's a really body thing, and it's not quite as dramatic as the head being blown up, but, you know, or blown off. But it's a kind of heart thing too. And
No, I understand.
And I just wanted to read... one little section from Hotel Emergencies. I'm just pulling it up here on my phone.
Technology meets poetry right here in front of me with Paula Green this afternoon on Afternoons. Very nice.
It's really crazy. I left the book on the bed at home. So this is just a little stanza in the middle, and it's a kind of list poem, and it sounds so amazing. It's got this really amazing human pulse to it, you know, like a beating heart inside of the poem that makes it matter so much. So, this is just one verse in the middle. "Which is here as a Muslim sound, which is here as a Christian sound, which is here as a Jewish sound, which is here as a merciful God sound, which is here as a praying sound, which is here as a kneeling sound, which is here as a scripture sound, which is here as a black wing sound, as a dark cloud sound, as a black ash sound, which is given as a howling sound, which is given as a fire alarm sound." So you've got this whole pile up of stanzas like that. And he was prompted to write that poem after hearing a fire alarm go off in his hotel somewhere when he was travelling overseas. But it becomes a kind of, he's just speaking to the world, the state of the world. And it feels like such an important poem to be reading now, you know, because our sounds are multiple.
Our sounds are multiple. With Paula Green this afternoon on Bookmarks, I'm Wallace Chapman in for Jesse Mulligan this afternoon. It's 24 away from 3 o'clock, and with Paula right up until 3 o'clock. Okay, so why don't we get into some music? So speaking of celebrating you, why don't we... actually, you've chosen a piece by Maria Callas. Can you explain...
Have.
Yes, beautiful. Can you explain this for us?
Well, I picked this, you know, I've just got so many albums at home, but I picked this because I wanted to underline how your tastes change. And I'm thinking, you know, I'm getting older now, and sometimes I have an image that when you get older, everything, you know, everything shuts down and doors close. But for me, it's the opposite. I feel like the older I get, the more things open. And I love that. I hope it keeps going.
The older I get,
the more things open up.
More things open.
Yeah. And so,
love it. I'm going to remember that.
When I was in my sort of like late teens, early 20s, I had really dramatic, dogmatic statements like, I will never eat imported oranges, okay? And I probably still don't. I will never listen to country music. Actually, I do. I will never listen to opera. It makes me nauseous. But somehow over the decades, I've grown to absolutely love opera. And, you know, when you hear Maria Callas sing the song Casta Diva from Norma by Bellini, you know, it's her voice that conveys everything. You don't need to know the story. You don't need to know the thwarted love. You don't need to know the Romans are out there land hungry and violent. And you don't need to know that the central character is singing and calling for peace, because it's all there.
Her voice is all.
Of her voice, yeah.
I couldn't agree more. Shall we have a listen? Here we go. Maria Callas Casta Diva from Norma by Bellini. Here we go. Your afternoons, RNZ National, and this is a choice by Paula Green, writer, poet. It's Casta Diva, and I can just see it. It's really, really moved you.
It has.
In a major way.
Yeah, it makes me feel like crying. And I was actually tutoring once at the University of Auckland when I was doing my Italian degrees, and it played in the next room, and I had to stop. And I said, we just have to stop and listen to this audio. And we stopped, and then I started up again. Yeah.
I want to ask you, it might be a bit of a cheeky question, because, you know, some would say it's a very competitive question, but I'm going to ask you anyway. What do you think is the best book you've ever read?
I'm actually going to say the book I finished 30 minutes ago.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, I started reading it.
You just finished it.
Yeah. I finished it in a cafe in Ponsonby Road, and I started reading it in a cafe in Henderson on Friday, and I just had to stop on the first two pages. They were so amazing. The first sentence: when Taryn Corrick's sister was killed, she was carrying a book. And it's going to be one of those classic sentences in New Zealand literature. The book is by Elizabeth Knox, and it's called The Absolute Book. And it is absolutely... absolutely fantastic. And I've loved all her writing, from her memoirs
to Hawaii. What's that sentence again?
When Taryn Corrick's sister was killed, she was carrying a book. So this book is fantasy, but it is so much more than that. There are books through it. Books play an important role. Libraries play an important role. And what I love about the book, what just made me just want to read it all the time, even at my event in Palmerston North, I just wanted to keep reading this book, is that, you know, okay, it's fantasy, but and that's wonderful. I'm not really a fantasy addict, but, you know, I've loved this. But all the way through, if you kind of imagine this book like a cliff face, you've got these gold nuggets of wisdom which just kind of glint at you, and Elizabeth being at her witty and wisdom most best. And then you've got this strong undercurrent, this dark undercurrent, which is the state of the world. And it's there. This is a book of this moment. And you've also got on top of that the narrative, the characters, the plot. And there is such tension that, you know, I'm sitting in the kitchen knowing that I've got to get the washing in because it started to rain, but I can't because I just cannot stop reading. And, yeah, I
dear
felt
Lord.
Like...
I felt, good
you know,
grief.
Like, Pip Adam called the book a triumph. She's got a little quote on the back of the book. I haven't read any... reviews yet, because I always like to read a book fresh. So I'm actually not going to tell you anything about the book, because I want everyone to go and read the book fresh.
Beautiful.
And know that this book's a triumph. But this is just one example of their little bit of wisdom, and that is one of the characters talking about the importance of libraries, and that, you know, it's important that we pass knowledge from generation to generation. And to me, that's one of the things of Wild Honey. There's a passing of knowledge from generation to generation, because one day it might be vital, we might not foresee it, but one day it might be beautiful, or one day it might simply be intriguing. And I just loved that. It just felt so important, you know. Yeah.
Extraordinary story. The best book you've ever read. You finished it half an hour ago, and it's by Elizabeth Knox. That title again of the book?
Is The Absolute Book.
The Absolute Book. A triumph. All right, that's on my list.
Yeah.
Paula Green this afternoon, you made sure that we would fit this piece of music in, because obviously, Paula, music is a big part of your life.
It is, yes. And it's a big part of poetry. I can remember I got taken into a year 10 group of boys somewhere and to do poetry, and they just said, "Why are you here? Poetry." And they just groaned, and I said, "Do you like music?" And they went, "Yeah." And I said, "Perfect, poetry's music." And from there we leapt off. But yeah, my next piece of music.
So the next piece of music is by Nina Simone. Tell us about where you first heard her. What does she mean to you?
I just loved playing. Well, my father loved jazz and blues, and would put that on the turntable, and I loved it all through my life. I've loved blues and jazz. I loved Billie Holiday, Ella Fitzgerald, Nina Simone and all these people. But when I lived in London, I got to hear Nina Simone at Ronnie Scott's on the nightclub there, which was just breathtaking.
You saw her live in a small space?
Yeah. So I got to hear her sing these songs. But I was thinking, you know, what a difference it makes when you can say, I was at the Rolling Stones in the 1970s at Western Springs on that bright blue sky day with his bright blue jumpsuit, you know. And it affects you. I heard Bob Marley there, and I was there at Aotea Centre when Prince was there, like with that radioactive piano, and I had a foot in a moon boot, and shortly later he died. And it was just like every single person in that room, auditorium, was filled with the power of music and the love of music. The reason I've picked Nina Simone is because this song is called Mississippi Goddamn, and to me this is a goddamn moment in the world. This is the time when poets and musicians and filmmakers are saying goddamn, you know, and we've got lots of young poets like Orselina Tusitala Marsha, late recent poet laureate, doing her fast-talking PI poetry and a new book coming out of poets responding to Ihu Matau, Te Tibu, Kalumile, Isame Ranipiri. You know, these things are important. This is a goddamn moment about, in so many ways, poets are saying something about the homeless and the hungry and, you know, intolerance and racism and so on. So, yeah, I just want to sit back and listen to Nina sing this song.
Fantastic. Here we go. Mississippi Goddam, Nina Simone.
The name of this tune is Mississippi Goddam. And I mean every word of it. Alabama's gotten me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. And everybody knows about Mississippi Goddam. Alabama's gotten me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. And everybody knows about Mississippi Goddam. Can't you see it? Can't you feel it? It's all in the air. I can't stand the pressure much longer. Somebody say a prayer. Alabama's gotten me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. And everybody knows about Mississippi Goddam. This is a show tune, but the show hasn't been written for it yet. Hound dogs on my trail, school children sitting in jail, black cat cross my path, I think every day's gonna be my last. Lord have mercy on this land of mine, we all gonna get it in due time. I don't belong here, I don't belong there, I've even stopped believing in prayer. Don't tell me, I'll tell you. Me and my people just about do. I've been there, so I know. Keep on saying, go slow. But that's just the trouble. Washing the windows. Just plain rotten. You're too damn lazy. You think it's crazy. Where am I going? What am I doing? I don't know. I don't know. Just try to do your very best. Stand up, be counted with all the rest. Cause everybody knows about Mississippi Goddam. I bet you thought I was kidding, didn't you? Picket lines, school boycotts, they try to say it's a communist plot. All I want is equality for my sister, my brother, my people, and me. Yes, you lied to me all these years. You told me to wash and clean my ears and talk real fine just like a lady. And you'd stop calling me Sister Sadie. Oh, but this whole country is full of lies. You all gonna die and die like flies. I don't trust you anymore. You keep on saying, go slow. Go slow. But that's just the trouble. Desegregation. Mass participation. Unification. Do things gradually. But bring more tragedy. Why don't you see it? Why don't you feel it? I don't know. I don't know. You don't have to live next to me. Just give me my equality. Everybody knows about Mississippi. Everybody knows about
Isn't it wonderful, Paula?
Yeah.
Oh, Paula Green this afternoon on Afternoons as part of Bookmarks. And it's interesting, isn't it, because it feels very relevant to hear this sort of song now, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Mm. Equality for your brothers, your sisters, your peoples, plural. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You have a tale that you would like to tell us, a bit of a special wee story, and it involves the Uffizi Gallery in Florence.
It does. When I was doing my master's, I went there to do some research on writers, but there was a Renaissance woman painter whose works were locked away, which I find, you know, that to me is kind of fitting with Wild Honey, because women's poetry was kind of locked away for much of the 20th century, had to get to. But so I wrote a letter in Italian about being a New Zealand scholar and could I come and see them. So I got a letter back at my hotel saying, be there, at, you know. So I got to go there an hour before the gallery started and opened up to the public. And so I went into the gallery and this young Italian guy with this big bunch of keys met me. And so usually if you go into the Uffizi Gallery, it's crowded and it's noisy. But I was in the room with all the Botticelli paintings, just me and Spring and the Birth of Venus. But then I got taken down all these corridors, right down to the sort of basement to where these paintings by Artemisia were hanging, you know. And so I just wanted to look at them. But this young guy sat there and watched me watching the paintings. And so I'm writing, you know, I write something. I'm just responding in writing. And it was just the most extraordinary experience to see this. And I was actually, I didn't realise it, but I was actually pregnant and I'd been vomiting in all the rubbish bins in Florence. So Michael and I, it was hot and noisy. We just thought, we'd get out of here, we'll go to Siena. So we just left, you know, decided to pack up and go. And the next day we woke up in Siena and there was this big sign on the museum in Siena saying, Chiuso, you know, it's closed because there's a bomb at Uffizi Gallery. And it turned out that those rooms that I'd been in, because he also said, where else? Che altro would you like to go? And he said, what about Caravaggio? And so, you know, he kept taking me to all these secret rooms that I'd show. And these were the rooms that got affected by the bomb that went off. And so those paintings that I'd looked at had been damaged. And I found it extraordinary on so many ways, in that I was one of the last people to see those works before they were damaged. But then the fact that I had to write a letter and get permission to see these, what were important paintings by this woman painter. I mean, I'm hoping that was in the 1990s, and I'm hoping that now her works are on display and much more accessible. But yeah, it was quite sort of, quite moving for me.
Closer to home, Paula, a place which is also very, very important to you, are the Alexander Turnbull Library Archives.
Yeah, I loved that. I did a lot of research there and I found things that really surprised me and that changed the way I read things. For example, there one of the first women to be published in English, Blanche Bourne, grew up in Britain and looked after her ill mother. And at some point she went on a world trip by herself, which I love, this woman going off, going around the world on a ship, you know, and then coming back to look after her ill mother. And then her mother died and she came to New Zealand, her favourite place, and settled in Canterbury and became a really fierce political activist and fought for suffragette movement and wrote poetry and was an extraordinary woman, and prison reform. I discovered this embargoed letter in the library, which said that Blanche's mother had killed Blanche's father and that she had been in a psychiatric place, well, probably then a madhouse, and then Blanche took her out and cared for her. So that was the illness. And then on the way to New Zealand, when her mother had died, Blanche fell in love with a Canadian engineer. And they wanted to get married, but Blanche said, no, I can't get married. Mm. I can never get married and I never can ever have children because I might have that insane gene, you know, and I might pass it on to my children. So she never did get married. And, you know, there was no evidence of this anywhere at all in any of her writing until I found this poem in her first book published in the 1880s, and I found this poem called Forgiven. Have I got time to read it?
Yes, you have.
And oh my gosh, it was just like a jolt through my heart to read this, because this is Blanche forgiving her mother. It's the only sign of this in all her work. Forgiven. Oh, bliss too exquisite for song, I'm at peace, my pain is past. For nature, holy, sweet and strong, hath drawn me back to her at last. Mother, lose not thy dear embrace from thy poor, passionate child again. I could not even dream thy face in that wild agony of pain. But now, the clouds are rolled away, the moon looks lovingly from heaven. Thousands of tender voices say, rest now, poor soul, thou art forgiven. And when I first read that poem, I had no idea what it meant. I skipped over it, you know. The moon caught my attention. Really, I skipped over it. But then reading that embargo, they had to wait till the last living relative died, and then you could read that piece.
It seems to be a full-on life for you, Paul. I mean, three books out, 2019. On a final note, what do you do to relax? How do you relax?
I relax by writing and cooking and gardening and running on the beach when my feet aren't broken. Writing is my joy. It's my love. You know, I love doing it. And also I have my blog poetry shelf I relax doing poetry shelf, you know, creating a centre for New Zealand poetry, which I keep trying to reinvent and make, you know, make more vital and draw communities together. But I just have always loved to write. I love the process of writing. And I do know that next year I want to be a private, secret, hermit-like year, you know, because Wild Honey's entry into the world has been completely wonderful and completely overwhelming, you know, and I feel like I actually need to go somewhere quiet for a while and write some secret things.
Paula Green, thank you very much for being with us this afternoon.